I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you enjoy listening to the LRB podcast, then you'll probably enjoy reading the LRB. You can subscribe to the LRB from just £1 per issue. To find out more, go to lrb.me/listen. That's lrb.me/listen. Or click on the link in the description below this episode.
Hello and welcome to the LRB podcast. I'm Adam Schatz, and my guest today is Raphael Branche, a historian at the University of Paris. Raphael is the author of several books, including Torture and the French Army During the Algerian War, a pathbreaking study published in 2002. Raphael's latest book, which I've reviewed in the current edition of the London Review of Books, is called Daddy, What Did You Do in Algeria? It was reviewed widely and admiringly in France. It's a major study of the experiences of French conscripts in Algeria, not only what they saw and did, but more importantly, how they did and didn't talk about it, both during the war and after. It's a book about memory and transmission and about silence, denial, and their legacy. So it's relevant not just to the study of the war itself, but to our understanding of France today. So thank you, Raphael, for joining us on the LRB podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Raphael, when we first met nearly 20 years ago, you just published Torture in the Army during the Algerian War. And this was at a time of intensifying interest around torture and repression during the war. You might even say its rediscovery, since people like Pierre Vidal-Naquet and Henri Allègue had exposed it during the war. Around the same time, General Paul Osares had boasted of his involvement in murdering Ali Boumengel and Larbi Benmidi, FLN activists, during the Battle of Algiers. And Louisette Iguilariz, an FLN fighter, had come forward with a very moving testimony of being tortured and then rescued by a French doctor. So your book and the works of other historians like Sylvie Thénault provided essential documentation of the French state's reaction to the uprising in Algeria and helped to shatter the silence about the war. But the book you've just written has a very different focus. Indeed, it's much more about the silence around the war and how it was produced within French families and, of course, also by the state. Can you talk a little bit about how you arrived at this subject?
Well, interestingly, you started by my first book because there is a link between the two. And I also started the last book by referring to this first work because I met the veterans of the Algerian War for my work on torture and illegal violence during the war. And it's a kind of, I don't know, personal process, you know, that year after year, I became aware of the fact that interviewing veterans was not enough, so to speak, to understand their words. I need to know more about their, you know, their background, their family background, their many things, and particularly the importance of their relatives and the way they were able to talk and to have their kids and their wives, especially, imagine the life they had in Algeria. So it was some sort of personal process And then it became a sort of scientific question for me.
Right. Personal in the sense that I think that after your book was published, some of the veterans and their family members actually contacted you, including some mm-hmm. who had been very uncomfortable about talking to you when you researched your first book.
Actually, it started for the book because I was looking for people wanting to speak about torture in late 90s. It was just before, you know, the sort of huge debate that's, you know, you mentioned at the beginning of our talk. And at that time, in the late 90s, nobody really speaks about, you know, violence in the Algerian War at that time particular. When I came to, you know, veterans asking for their testimonies, actually they were okay. I mean, they wanted to speak. I mean, I had just one out of 40 that was not willing to speak about what I called illegal violence. So at that time, I experienced the way that, you know, they were really happy to speak, so to speak, or eager to speak because they were in their, you know, early 60s, beginning to start a new life as young, retired people. So I had this experience that they wanted to speak to me, or they were okay to speak to me. And it was a contrast with the fact that, you know, most people said to me, my father, he doesn't want to speak, or my brother, he never spoke about that, or he's always silent, or he's keeping silent. When you ask him, he doesn't want to answer. And, you know, I had my own experience that they were okay. And they, well, even to speak about rape, it was not so easy, actually. But to speak about torture was, you know, possible with me, but not with their relatives.
Well, you know, I want to talk to you about the question of transmission, of course, and what they did and didn't say to their relatives. But first, I want to talk to you a bit about the appelé, the conscripts. Because the impression one gets is that this really was not a rebellious generation. Indeed, quite the contrary. This, in fact, you cite a survey, I think it was conducted by the sociologist Henri Lefebvre, that most of them thought their lives would be pretty much the same as their parents' lives.
Yeah, I find that fascinating. And yeah, definitely we're not in some sort of rebel generation at all compared to their younger brother and sisters. That for some of them, you know, were activists in 68, but definitely no, they were not. You know, the movement I'm doing in the book is not to consider the conscripts as of their 20s. You know, they are 20 and then they go to war and then they experience a war and then they are coming home and they have difficulties to speak and so on and so forth. What I did in the book is to start in the 30s. To have them as children and to study their childhood, to understand how they experience the world and, you know, the sort of the way of imagining their future. You know, really, they grew up in the shadow of war, so to speak. You know, the Second World War was just in the offing and then the First World War was just everywhere in France, you know, and with all these little villages with this, you know, war memorials and all that. And I had the sense that, you know, that the weight of the two world wars were understudied, you know, by historians and they were not considered as children of war, but they are children of war, certainly.
Right. And if there was one thing they were familiar with, it was war, both the First and the Second World War. The lesson they drew from their experiences was that men went to war at some point.
Definitely.
So so very few of them put up any resistance to the idea of going to Algeria. And of course, in fact, they'd been told that this wasn't a war. It was just an operation to maintain order. Algeria was France. The interior minister at the time, François Mitterrand, said that, you know, Algeria is France and you know, it's going to stay that way. So, you know, what did the conscripts think they were getting into when they went to Algeria, right? For many of them, it was their first time abroad. What did they think they were going to be doing there?
Well, many things in your questions. But the thing is, yes, men were supposed to go to war, but they were not going to war. They were going to do their, you know, military duty as conscripts. And so they were sent to Algeria, but Algeria was France. You know, it was really France. It was part of France, so to speak, in an administrative way, of course. They were not sent overseas. It was not Indochina or Africa. It was France, and they had to do their duty. You know, in reality, it was not the fact. Actually, what they discovered in Algeria was colonialism, poverty. I think they also discovered the amount of lies, you know, because they were told that Algeria was France, but it was not, definitely not. I mean, people were not able to understand French. Children, you know, walk in the street without shoes. And you know, the misery was everywhere. And it was a huge, huge shock for, you know, many, many conscripts, as you can read in their letters. So they were not aware of colonialism, you know, the reality of it. And they were not aware that they had to, you know, they will be in danger. And their family was not aware, were not aware as well. You know, they were not facing war. They were just facing eventually rebellion, you know, some sort of light danger.
Right, because the rebels were called hors-la-loi, outlaws.
They were called outlaws, yes. And it was supposed to be, you know, maintenance of order operations. So something, yes, not without danger, but not really a war.
You quote actually a saying that it was more dangerous to drive from Paris to the south of France than to go to Algeria, which is quite striking. I was also taken by this contrast between the first letters that they wrote home, where they sent often on these picturesque 19th century postcards of colonial Algeria, and the conscripts talk about, you know, the incredible blue sky and the Bay of Algiers, and then they start to write about what they see and the poverty and the misery, and you really get a sense of their shock. But what are they telling their loved ones back home in Algeria when they start to write? What are they telling them? Because I get the sense that even during the war, they were already creating these, what you call structures of silence. They were already creating these no-go zones. I mean, there were exceptions, of course. There were some people who were quite explicit about what they saw. But on the whole, it seems they were already creating this space of secrecy.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I wanted to go back to these first narratives because I think one of the key elements of the silence is really there, you know, the way they, because they spent 1 or 2 years in Algeria. And people have to remember that they had no opportunity to come back to France or to talk to their relatives. So the importance of what they wrote is really big. I mean, it's much bigger than, of course, now any letter could or would be.
They weren't dashing off emails and texts.
No email, no WhatsApp, and no telephone even. So just letters. So these first words on the reality that they saw, it has to do with their wish to protect their family, so not to talk about the danger they were facing. And also, it also had to do with their own possibility, ability to understand the situation, because they were not really, you know, they didn't know nothing. They didn't know nothing about the Algerian situation, about nationalism, about poverty. So they had also this meaning that, well, you can have this sense of, you know, they are different from us. They are savages, or they don't know how to take care of their children, and all this sort of, you know, colonial mind, so to speak. That was also a filter, you say? A filter?
A filter.
A filter, yeah. To understand, you know, the reality they had to deal with. So this is also in their first narratives. And then when they came back, you know, they were not able to change the narrative so easily. So some of them were able to address issues such as violence, for example, or poverty, or guilt, or shame, or whatever. but most of them didn't at the time of the war. And then when they came back, it was just the same. And they keep on saying, you know, it was okay, no danger, it was fun, it was boring, it was, you know, but nothing of the real reality of the experience for many.
And very, very few of them penetrated the colonial facade and developed real relationships to Algerians. You talk about these Meshwi feasts, and there are a couple of examples of conscripts who actually developed friendships. There's, in fact, one striking example of a Frenchman who falls in love with an Algerian woman who was the widow of an FLN fighter. Mm. But those encounters were very rare. For the most part, the Algerians remained inaccessible to them.
Yeah, but it is not so much because of the colonial facade. It's because of the war. I mean, the war was waged against guerrilla fighters, of course. But in the end, the real enemy was not the guerrilla fighters. The real enemy was something quite strange, because it was the civilian population, but not as an enemy, as a target. A target of a war that was something strange, because it was, on the one hand, combat, and on the other hand, you know, building schools, building roads, teaching mother how to take care of their kids. So this,
right, because there was this whole kind of campaign to win hearts and minds.
Absolutely. So the situation in which they could have, you know, met, you know, Algerians and with a possibility of becoming friends,
very limited.
Very limited. I did a questionnaire for the veterans, and one of my questions was, did you make friends? Something like that. And what about, have you stayed in contact with them? Or something like that. And to me, you know, I meant French friends, I mean veterans. And for some of them, they understood the question as Algerian friends. So they answered it like, impossible, lots of, you know, like exclamation points, like is she stupid or what? That was very funny.
You know, you decided to limit your study to the conscripts. Mm-hmm. Now, I wonder, I wanted to ask you a bit more about how you made that decision, because part of the French family, so to speak, today is Algerian French. In those families, you also had structures of silence, as we've been reminded by, to take one example, the very compelling recent documentary on the regroupment camps by Dorothée Myriam Kalou, which I'm sure you've seen. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, was this partly a matter of discretion or of pudeur, a kind of a feeling that this is really a subject for a French historian of Algerian roots to write? And what was the reason you limited the study to the conscripts themselves, since these structures of silence are shared by many?
Well,
or many others, rather. maybe too vast a subject.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, really, I didn't even envisage another, you know, way of, you know, dealing with the subject of silence. Because, of course, you have silence all over society and in many milieu. But, you know, the specificities of conscripts are real. I mean, it's different from professional soldiers. It's different from Harkis. It's different, you know, from what you mentioned, the French that had to come to France at the end of the Algerian War. But no, it's really different, because you have, well, yes, so I find it, you know, enough. So there's...
Exactly.
Sorry.
No, that makes sense. You know, about a decade ago, Laurent Mauvigné, a French writer, published a remarkable novel, mm-hmm, called Des Hommes. Some Men. It was translated into English as The Wound. Mm-hmm. Now, I was reminded of the novel at several points while reading your book. You, in fact, mentioned the novel. One of your subjects, a socialist conscript named Jacques Henrep, who went on to become an activist against the war, wrote in a letter after witnessing an atrocity by his fellow soldiers, "These are not men. Ce ne sont pas des hommes." And that, of course, reminded me of the Mauvigné novel. Now, in that novel, there's a scene where one of the characters is witnessing an atrocity in a village, and his mind wanders to the Nazi massacre in the French town of Oradour-sur-Glane. Now, when I read that book, I thought, really? Is this soldier thinking about Oradour while he's in Algeria? It seemed a little bit forced to me. Mm-hmm. But now that I've read your book, it's clear to me that it was not a forced moment at all, because a number of the soldiers you write about drew this analogy, talked about Oradour. Why Oradour? What gave that such resonance?
Yeah, one has to remember that when the war broke out in 1954, I mean, it was 9 years after the end of Second World War. So it was, and 10 years after Oradour. So really nothing, you know. And these guys, they had the news of Oradour had a huge impact, at the moment in during the liberation of France, because it was a massacre of a whole village. Whereas you have many cases of massacre in Poland and Eastern Europe, it's very rare in France. So it really had a huge impact at that time. But you also had to remember that in 1953, there was a trial in France, which also had a huge impact, because who was sent to trial? It was the man who had participated in this crime, French and German, because part of the Oradour SS division were composed by Alsatian soldiers.
Were these the milice, or were they?
No. It was SS regiment, but you had this the Malgré nous, so French from Alsace, but incorporated into the Reich as German. So you had this sort of, it was also a French story, this Oradour Nazi massacre. So it had a huge impact in 1953, which is just 1 year, before, and the men were convicted, and then you had an amnesty. So because, you have the Alsace against Limousin and all this. And the other thing is that when they arrived in Algeria, and I mean, certainly, the vast majority of them, they had this feeling that they were the soldiers occupying a land, and you had the civilians, and especially the children, and they speak very much about the children, because, I mean, this children is of course, it's innocence and it's all that, but they were also children themselves during the war, and they had experienced gentle Nazi or German soldiers, occupying France, and this strange feeling to be on the wrong side of history was very strong and very uncomfortable for them. So,
and at the same time, the FLN was modeling itself on the wartime Maquis, right?
Yeah, definitely. And the FLN was using it. I mean, politically using it, because they had that showed the reference to the GPRF. They labeled their own government as GPRA, really echoing de Gaulle's GPRF.
The you're talking about the provisory, the Algerian the government in exile.
Absolutely, yes. They really use the same label as de Gaulle had in 1944 in Algiers. So, this reference is everywhere for all the participants, all the actors of the war. The Oradour is something special because it's a crime. It's a war crime, and it's some sort of symbol of Nazism in France for its worst aspects.
And of course, the soldiers who offer the most eloquent testimony about and tend to make this allusion to the occupation in France, mm-hmm. generally come from left-wing backgrounds, either socialist or communist, or appear to, no? I mean,
no, I'm not so sure.
You quote from both Jacques Anrep and also this young communist named Marcel Yanelli. And, as you note early in the book, the Communist Party of France didn't discourage soldiers from going to Algeria. They thought that the soldiers should go there and campaign for peace, not that they should resist the war.
Absolutely.
Which is remarkable too.
Absolutely. The French Communist Party has a responsibility, for these young boys that, were really willing to do something for the Algerian people, and they were told just to go and try to do it, in the middle of, the rank and files. And it was something like, well, just impossible to do, actually.
And they realized they couldn't.
No, they couldn't.
And so their letters expressed such frustration and despair.
Yeah, yeah, that's really. I mean, when you were really a militant, as Marcel Iannelli is, and I had the chance to be able to read his, you know, his diaries and his letters, and he is really, you know, he's fighting against himself. He's really, he's shameful. He's really unhappy because he's not succeeding in his, you know, in his work, in his job as a good communist that should be to be able to convince people not to do the revolution or to go on strike, but just to respect human beings. Because actually what he's really trying to do is to speak and to talk about, you know, respecting civilians, respecting prisoners. But I just want to mention the fact that it's not only, you know, leftists, soldiers or soldiers with, you know,
progressive backgrounds.
Yeah, this background, because, well, two things. I mean, they were very young. At the age of 20, you cannot vote. And they were not very, you know, politicized.
Mm.
I mean, you mentioned the Lefebvre sondage, you know, how they envisaged their you know, their future. And they couldn't imagine something else than their parents' life, and it's also the case as far as politics is concerned. So you know, militants are a minority, obviously. And the other thing is, as far as human rights are concerned, a way of telling it. It's that you also had people with Christian backgrounds very upset by you know, violence committed in Algeria and. At least violence against civilians or a massacre of villages. And you also had this part of, you know, the conscript that were eager to compare to Nazi occupation in France and very, very uncomfortable about this echo.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
In the 70s, France was swept by a wave of remembrance of Vichy, of the Holocaust, of France's complicity. And this was prompted by the publication of Robert Paxton's mm-hmm. great book on Vichy, and also by the Old Fools film, The Sorrow and the Pity, Le Chagrin et la Pitié. Mm-hmm. Now, it's at precisely this time that the French seem to be doing everything in their power to forget Algeria, to just put it behind them, to put it out of their minds. How is it that the forgetting of Algeria coincides with the reckoning with the Holocaust?
Oh. Huh.
It's kind of it just seems to me rather remarkable that you could have this forgetting and this remembering going on at once.
I'm not a specialist of the Holocaust memory, but you know that, you know, this turning point of 1971 with the Chagrin et la Pitié is also a turning point from the Algerian memory point of view, because you have in 1971-1972, you have three books that were issued at the same time on the Battle of Algiers and on torture, and that really started some sort of public debate about.
Didn't Jacques Massu publish a book in 1972?
Absolutely, Jacques Massu, La Vraie Bataille d'Alger, and General de la Boulardière, Battle of Algiers, Battle of Man, and Pierre Vidal-Naquet had his book published and translated into French.
Torture in the Republic.
Mm-hmm. So you had this sort of debate right at the same time. And then it faded away. And then it disappeared. But I don't know if you have, well, if there is a link, you know, because certainly there is. But I haven't, you know, been too much into it. On the contrary, at the end of the 90s, you also find a link between the Vichy memory and the Algerian War.
During the Papon trial.
It's the Papon trial that is really, to my mind, it's really the turning point where, you know, the obsession of the Vichy past gives way. And then the Algerian War came to the front and started being what it is until today, which is the massive, supposedly, problem.
Right, because this is at a moment when Maurice Papon is on trial.
Yeah.
For crimes committed during the occupation. And at the same time, we're reminded that Papon, after the war, not only became involved in the Algerian War, right? He was posted there.
Yeah, he was the head of Constantine Région at the beginning of the war, and then the head of Paris Prefect.
But then he became the Paris Prefect and presided over the October 17, 1961 massacre of Algerian demonstrators.
Yeah, definitely. This, you know, the trial was restricted to the Second World War and the complicity of, you know, crime against humanity, but you know, at the beginning of the process of the beginning of the trial, you have this, you know, mention of his responsibility that couldn't be addressed in the judicial arena, thanks to the amnesty, thanks to lots of things. But yes, it was mentioned, and it really, you know, went with the fact that, you know, public memory was going elsewhere and interested more and more on the Algerian past.
Now, when the conscripts returned, not many people wanted to hear what they'd seen. One of your subjects, a man named Michel Berthélémy, a conscript, had accidentally killed a boy from a balcony, and he's haunted by this, but no one wants to listen to him when he comes back. And you get the sense that the conscripts felt... they felt ashamed. After all, they had been defeated. Algeria was lost. And to make things worse, they were also, in popular culture, stereotyped as these rednecks, as these drunks who were haunted by the past. And I'm thinking particularly of the so-called boeuf, this caricature by the late cartoonist Cabu and Charlie Hebdo. Can you talk a little bit about what that caricature signified?
Well, definitely there is some sort of popular character. I mean, the veteran of the French war in Algeria, but definitely very different from what you have in the States, for example. It's something that still has to be studied, actually. I mean, the presence of these characters in literature and film, but the beauf, the Cabu's beauf, also has to do with anti-militarism. You know, you mentioned Charlie Hebdo and, you know, this, you know, one of their
editorial lines.
The editorial line was really about, you know, against the army as a whole.
Sure.
So the beauf is this sort of drunk man, fat man, sexist, and really a caricature. But indeed, it's something that, in a way, silenced the conscript, because they felt they were different from this caricature. And it was, among many other things, I mean, you know, images that really silenced them, because they felt at least indifference from their relatives or from the society about their experience, and refusal to hear about the specificities of what they had experienced there. So the beauf was more like a sort of un repoussoir, you know, something you really don't want to be associated with. And the problem is, you have no positive image of, you know, anybody that has been fighting in Algeria. So you just have French officers like General Massu. You have professional officers, you know, like General Bijard. You have some positive images, but they were not conscripts. So for the conscripts, it was just like a nowhere. And they were nowhere. So people were expecting them to go back to their normal life and forget about the war.
And they were told that, after all, you know, war is the Battle of Verdun.
Yeah.
That really wasn't even a war, and you shouldn't complain. You should just forget what you saw. I mean, and you talk about in your book about how some of the conscripts, when they came home, went to great efforts to just forget the war. You mentioned there's an anecdote about the great screenwriter Jean-Claude Carrière, collaborator of Buñuel, a great screenwriter who went to one of the bridges in Paris with his wife, I believe, and tossed out all their letters.
Yeah.
Shame you didn't have those letters to read.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm sure they would have been very good.
Yeah. Well, I'm not so sure. You know, when you read, you know, a couple correspondence, is just love and love and love and and I miss you and I love you and it's, you know, but maybe I know.
Now the war had these lasting psychological effects on the conscripts and much of the literature and the film of the latter part of the war, but also the period just after the war, depicts that trauma. And I'm thinking of things like Alain René's film Muriel, or the Temps d'un Retour, which is a very powerful reflection on war trauma, or Daniel Anthelme's novel La Permission. Mm-hmm. And yet few in the medical establishment were willing to consider that the war, which, as you said, wasn't a war, had any such effect. But then you write about these two remarkable men. One is Jacques Anrep, we've mentioned, and the other is Bernard Sieg. Can you talk a bit about what they, how they came to see this war as having a profound kind of traumatic effect on the conscripts?
Yeah, one of them, Jacques Anrep, was a conscript,
and the other is a deserter.
And the other is a deserter, so that makes a big difference. Mm. And Jacques Anrep finally decided to quit the job his father and mother wanted him to do. And he started a career as a psychiatric nurse in the late 60s, and then he wrote about traumatic and especially on torture, on the effects of torture on victims. And as a veteran, he wrote several texts on this experience, because at the time of the war, he was just one of the rare whistleblowers, you know, trying to give information to the press, or at least to the militant press, to alert and denounce, I mean, the reality of what French army was doing in Algeria. So that's part of Jacques Anrep's involvement in denouncing the crimes from the war until today, actually. And what I found out, because I knew him from, you know, a long time, but what I discovered was his involvement in the clandestine movement against the OAS,
the secret army organization,
some sort of fascist organization against the Gaullist regime when he came back I can't remember, 1961 or 1960. The situation of Bernard Sieg is quite different, and as a psychiatrist, because he was a doctor at the time, and as a psychiatrist, he was really aware of the psychiatric wounds and the effects of the war on, you know, several people he had to, well, he met, you know, in Morocco.
Because he was at a military hospital in Morocco, and he was seeing soldiers.
Yeah, absolutely.
He was seeing soldiers who'd fought in Algeria.
Yeah. And then...
And isn't that what led him to desert, in fact?
It's not really clear, actually, when you ask him. He's part of this, as we mentioned before, you know, the communist people, or at least, you know, people from that kind of political
milieu
that was, he was not really willing to go, but he didn't know what to do. And finally he decided not to, because he was, you know, not happy with what he heard of. That's basically what I know from what he told me. But then he forgot about it. And he went to the States. He did several things. He read, of course, about traumatic disorder and all that. And he was asked by the president of one of the veteran associations in France, a communist one, to, you know, just to think about, you know, the situation of French veterans in the 80s. So he was the only one, actually, to really try to document the reality of what we can call traumatism, but it really had no name at that time regarding these people. So he was the first, and he published his book on silence and how is it called? Le silence et la névrose, I think. Well, something about
silence and neuroses.
Yeah. Well, so they you know, were really the rare people interested in the subject and trying to document it in the, you know, in the 70s and 80s.
Right. And for the sake also of public health and to provide psychiatric services to veterans who wouldn't otherwise have gotten them.
Not at that time. You know, you had.
And that took a while.
Yeah, that took, you know, until the, you know, in the 90s, you had nothing really done for the veterans in the French. That's totally, you know, nothing. Well, basically, you had to wait until the Gulf War to really have, you know, military psychiatrists interested in the issue of
war trauma,
PTSD. Yeah,
you know, you show in the book that as much as these families tried to forget Algeria remained very much in the home.
Yeah.
There were, you know, you talk about the memorabilia, the so-called souvenirs. Mm-hmm. Many of them mm-hmm. were stolen. By the soldiers from Algerian homes that they'd raided or from FLN fighters who had been killed. Mm-hmm. And I was reminded of Althusser's concept of the structuring absence, you know, something that isn't mentioned in a text but is nevertheless everywhere present.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. Yeah, I should have used it, yes. Well, it's, I don't know if it's structuring, you know, as such, but it's present, yes. And I also wanted to not only document the silence, but document the presence and document the way Algeria or something that is that was called Algeria and not the war, like infuse, you know, the families through, you know, recipes and, of course, music and all
and words. Words that people used.
And, for example, yes, words like, you know, common words, yes.
You know, another legacy of the war and, of course, of colonization, the 130 years that France was in Algeria, was racism. And yeah. you talk about a special racism directed against Algerians, even more than against other subjects of the French Empire. How is this anti-Algerian racism different, in your view, from other such racisms?
Actually, I don't know. It's an idea. I mean, it's even a notion that was first raised by Benjamin Stora. I mean, the fact that some sort of legacy is something specific towards men, I should say, and add, not women, but men of Algerian descent or North African descent in France, starting with crimes, I mean, murders of these people in Marseille at the beginning of the 70s, for example. You have, you know, specific, you know, crimes, racist crimes, and going to, I mean, the issue of the Islamic veil and all that. And then the women came into, you know, into play. But still, I think you have something special regarding male and of this, you know.
Right, the fear of the Algerian male.
Yeah.
And of course, I mean, Stora has suggested that there's a link, too, to the emergence of the far right, of the National Front, which is now called the Rassemblement National.
Mm-mm.
Jean-Marie Le Pen was, of course, a paratrooper and a torturer. I mean,
yeah.
Stora calls it Sudisme, I think, or Southernism.
Absolutely.
Do you think that even today there's such a link between the memory of the Algerian War and the politics of the far right, or has that diminished?
No, that's definitely still here, and it's not only the far right, it's part of the right in France, definitely. And it's not only Stora. I mean, it's the history of the far right that is really linked to some sort of radicalism in Algeria at the time of the war. And that is actually being studied, you know, by historians. I mean, the link, I mean, the people really crossing Mediterranean with these ideas, that is really bringing to the far right in France something specific, different from other, you know.
And there's already this discourse long before Renaud Camus of a great replacement and the fear of counter-colonization. There's the famous remark of De Gaulle about about, you know, wanting to make sure
demography.
About demography.
Absolutely. Yeah, you had this, you know, the argument of, you know, figures are our worst enemy, so we have to, you know, leave them because they are too, they will outnumber the French, the real French. Yes.
And take our women and so on.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned Benjamin Stora, the great historian of Algeria, who also published a book about structures of silence earlier on called the La Gangrène et l'Oubli, some ways a kind of precursor to this book that you've published. Now, at the request of President Macron, he's just filed a report on the war and has proposed a commission of memory and truth. He's called for the French state to acknowledge, among other things, the murder of Ali Boumendjel, the FLN lawyer. But at the same time, Stora has discouraged any expression of repentance. He says that it's a trap, it's a piège of the far right. I'm wondering, have you read Stora's report, and what do you think about the conclusions so far as you've studied them?
Yes, I read it rapidly, but I know, well, I spoke with him, and I think I know what he means.
I say that also with all due respect. I think Stora is a brilliant and admirable man.
Definitely, yeah, definitely, and is definitely the first historian who was ever able to address the issue of collective memory in France and Algeria in the same book. Public memory more than family memory, but yes, definitely in the early 90s. Yeah, I think I agree. I definitely agree with him when he mentioned the fact that the repentance issue is a trap and is something, you know, the far right really managed to impose on, you know, on the public, on the political agenda, which is totally absurd. I mean, it's something the far right, and not only the far right, actually, you know, the right mostly, and probably even more and more people are not wanting to do, because repentance is something that has to do with, you know, with the church, with the Christian lexicon, and it also means
a formal apology.
Yeah, something people don't want to hear about it. But it's also because it has been presented as a demand of the Algerian state, which is not so clear. I mean, when you look at, you know, the 60 years from, you know, of you know, French and Algerian relationship, it's not. It has not always been, you know, this demand for apologies.
Not to mention an Algerian state, which the vast majority of Algerians don't even like.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. Of course, that's part of the problem. I mean, who are we talking to? Who do we want to talk to? I mean, this issue of reconciliation, for me, it's something totally vain. I mean, we are not, you know, we are not crossed. You know, people are, you know, we are okay. I mean, people are living, I mean, many, many Algerians live in France, go to France. And you know, I think we have nothing, no problem, really, as far as the people are concerned. And even as far as the states are concerned, when you look at, you know, the commercial relationship, the strategical relationship, I mean, we are close in many ways. So this issue of, you know, war of memories, you know, I don't understand it really.
Now, the Algerian War ended in 1962, so it will soon cease to be a living memory in France. What, in your view, are the stakes involved in France achieving this so-called reconciliation? I mean, what would it accomplish if it were even possible? What is the meaning of this whole project, in your view?
Well, I see at least two questions in your question. The one is, what could be done or would be better than what is proposed, and what is proposed in his report or book? Benjamin Stora has many, you know, proposals, such as, you know, symbolic ones, interesting ones, you know, to build statue or to, you know, well, why not? I mean, definitely, why not? And the issue of, you know, victims for the nuclear experimentation is also a very sensitive issue. And why not? And the other is about the archives and this commission you mentioned. The problem is, regarding this aspect, that we have no Algerian counterparts. I mean, we French historians. So you can always say, yes, a mixed commission would be interesting. But the fact is that you already have one between French and Algerian as far as regarding the archives, and it's not working. And that's all. And from my point of view, the real political way of addressing this is not so much about the Algerian War, but about the colonial past of the French in Algeria and in general, but let's talk only about the Algerian aspect. And it's something that is really about injustice, discrimination, and not addressing the, you know, the impact of this on the way we see, we French, we see the Algerian, we imagine the Algerian until today, is something that is really missing. I mean, and it has to do with a political agenda. Well, it could be, you could, for example, you have people living in France for, let's say, 20 years, being able to vote on, you know, on the, how do you say, municipal, you know, the
municipal elections,
the country election, well, the county or the, well, local elections. And the socialists at a time, you know, long ago, they had the sense that by doing some sort of actual political gesture, they would address the issue of the past, of the present and the future in the same, you know, in the same movement. It's not what it's doing. So we have problem facing, you know, violence from, you know, the cops in France, discrimination on the basis of, you know, the color of the skin, for housing, for, you know, schooling. So all these issues are not addressed. And I think it's really a problem.
Raphael, it was such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for joining us on the LRB podcast.
Thank you, Adam.
You can read my piece on Raphael's book in the latest issue of the LRB online now, along with Patricia Lockway on Elena Ferrante, Jenny Turner on Octavia Butler, and Thomas Powers on Robert Stone.
Thanks for listening. You can find a link to LRB pieces relevant to this episode in the description below.